This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
At chapter 2, verse 4, Perek Beis, Posuk Dalet. Having completed the 6 days of creation, the story of the world really begins. And it begins with some greater detail about the creation itself, certainly in as much as it affects man. So this section starts with a very strange opening. Eile toldos hashomayim v'ha'oretz behibarom. These are the generations of the heavens and the earth when they were created. This is the story of creation, which really should be the way the Torah started right at the beginning. Its opening phrase should have been, before Bereshis, it should have said, Eile toldos hashomayim v'ha'oretz behibarom. This is the story, this is the history of the creation of heaven and earth when they were created. And then it should have started Bereshis, Baro Elokim, Es HaShemayim, Es HaOretz, and so on. It's a strange point here, after the completion of the creation, to start saying all of a sudden, Eileh told us, these are the generations of the heaven and the earth. And in order to resolve that, Rashi says, Eileh HaAmurim Lamalo. Eileh, these 7 days about which we have just finished learning, were the beginning of the history of the creation of the earth. But normally it isn't read that way. Normally when it says, Eile told us, it's talking about what's about to come. And it's really a bit of a combination of both, because what we're talking about now is the introduction of man into the equation. And that's when the story really starts. So Eile told us, this is the story. A story has to have characters to it. You can't have a story without human characters. So up till now it hasn't really been a story. Up till now it's been some historic facts. But historic facts don't constitute a story. There's no fiction to it. There's no artistry to it. There's no plot to it. It's only now that the man is introduced that we have to take a step back and look at that last day of creation again. We've got to look at what happened on that Friday. What happened on that Erev Shabbos when man was created? We were just glossed over it very quickly and said he created man. We're going to have to go into it in greater detail, because a lot happened that day. The moment man is put into the equation, all sorts of things start happening. And Eileh told us, Hashemayim v'oretz behibarom, these are the generations of the Shemayim v'oretz behibarom when they were created. And that word behibarom, with an emphasis on that little hey, you'll notice it's printed small because a lot revolves around that little hey. Firstly, behibarom, Chazal point out, are the same words as Avraham. And that's one of the reasons the hay is small, because he wasn't called Avraham all the time. He was called Avram without a hay first, and then he was called Avraham later. So Behibarom are the same letters. If you switch the letters around, you get the Be'Avraham, suggesting, as the Baraturim brings, that the world was created Bishus Avraham. It was because of one man that it was worth creating the earth. Had there been nothing else, had the world produced nothing more than one human being, that is Avraham, it would have been a worthwhile exercise. The entire creation would have been worthwhile for the creation of that one single human being, Avraham. The contribution he made, what he taught the world, what he stood for, the chesed, the kindness, the problems that he repaired in the world, one human being, it was worth, the whole exercise was worthwhile. And that's something that we need to recognize, and we often forget in today's world, where everything is mass-oriented. But the Torah doesn't work that way. The Torah focuses on single individuals. Because the impact of a single individual, the potential impact of a single individual on the rest of the world is virtually infinite. One person can change the world. The world can change one person as well. But it's important to know that one person can change the world, and that sometimes Hashem's perspective of the creation is such that for one individual person it would have been worthwhile. And that the focus is on that very often when one's educating. You educate a lot of people. You put up an educational institution and thousands of people pass through it. But you produce one Chofetz Chaim, or you produce one great personality. That one great personality, the whole exercise was worth it. Everybody else who went through that school, if it was just to produce that one personality, it's worthwhile. And so the focus of Lithuanian education always used to be to try and produce the one individual. Of course, in the process, everybody else benefited as well. But the level was directed at the highest point, not at the lowest common denominator. Today we're working with exactly the opposite. Today the tendency in all areas of communication is direct your communication at the lowest common denominator, because commercially that makes the most sense. If you've got to turn it into a business, then the only way you can make a business profitable is if you have enough volume. And you're going to have volume at the lower ends, you're never going to have volume at the higher ends. So unless you're dealing in a very, very big market. If you're in the United States, you can create a university which is designed for the top 2% of the population, because you're still going to have more people than you can possibly cater for. But if you've got but you can't have too many of those universities. If you're working in a smaller population, you can't function that way. It's not possible. From a business perspective. So we have to be careful when things, when everything's turned into a business, and we see it happening in Torah as well. Today there is a certain business dynamic to the establishment and the running of Torah institutions. And part of that dynamic is you have to have numbers. You have to have certain numbers of people to make it viable. Because the more people you have, the more grants you get from the government, and the more funds you can raise, and it's a vicious circle. And so you've got to grow, and you've got to have lots and lots of people. To have lots and lots of people, you've got to focus your educational message at the lowest common denominator, where the volume of people are. People are always structured in a pyramid sort of pyramidal sort of image. The more sophisticated the individual, the finer, the more noble the individual, the fewer of them there are. So if you're going to want to have volume, you've got to come to lower levels. And today we find it happening in a lot of areas. Sure, there are still the yeshivas that focus on the cream, on the really top, but they're very few and far between. Generally, there's a need to have volume. And the moment there's a need to have volume, there's a need to lower the level. Hashem says, I'm not interested. I'm interested in one Avraham. That's all. I designed this world to produce an Avraham. I didn't design the world for everybody else. Everybody else has a place, and everybody else will fit in. But if the world can produce one man like Avraham, I'm satisfied already. Then I've succeeded. It's been successful to produce one gem. That's all that one needs. In some areas, we understand it. It's a pity that it's in non-human areas that we understand that. The reason that diamonds are valuable and that people pay a lot of money for diamonds is because you have to dig out a lot of earth and throw away a lot of material and discard a lot of diamonds to come to the few diamonds that are really worthwhile, to get to the flawless ones, to get to the ones that are really, really beautiful stones and valuable gems. And the more one does that, the more worthwhile they are. So people will do that. People will invest in rarity when the rarity is an object. But people aren't so quick to invest in rarity when it comes to people. Then they like everybody to be the same. Should be the other way around. If you're dealing with objects, what difference does it make? Why is it so important? What difference does it make if your diamond is different to anybody else's diamond, or your dress is different to anybody else's dress, it shouldn't make all that much difference. What's important should be is that I'm different to anybody else. That there isn't another person like me. I don't think the same, I don't talk the same, I don't have the same taste. That's what should be important. The fact that we both went to Woolworths and bought the same outfit and were seen at the same party wearing the same outfit shouldn't make any difference. It's only a thing. What difference does it make? But we don't think like that when it comes to things. There they must all be unique, one-off pieces. And we get very upset if our dressmaker makes another dress for another person along the same lines, or we see another person wearing the same piece of jewelry. We're dealing with things, we want uniqueness. When we're dealing with people, we want uniformity. We've gone completely cockeyed. With people, there should be uniqueness. With things, there should be uniformity. When we look at people, we should value the differences between people, not the imitation. There's nothing to value the sameness. And now we feel secure. You walk into a room full of people, if they're all the same as you, you feel comfortable, you feel secure. It's not meant to be that way. That's where there needs to be uniqueness. And Behibarom, Be'Avraham, the Ribbono Shel Olam creates a world capable of producing unique individuals. That's what the world can do. This is a world in which you don't all have to grow the same. This is a world in which everybody doesn't have to look the same, and doesn't have to think the same, and doesn't have to hold the same opinion. Everybody can be different. That's really important. Last Friday night I spoke about the importance of appreciating that which differentiates the Jewish nation from other nations, that our nationhood is not by virtue of the fact that we all share the same opinions. Non-Jewish nationhood is by virtue of the fact that people share the same opinions. If you want to be classed as one group of people, you're a comrade among the communists if you share the same beliefs as the communists. Each one, you're a Freemason if you share the views of a Freemason. Each group of people have their beliefs and their values, and that's what makes you one of them. Becoming a Jew, you don't become a Jew by sharing the values of a Jew. That's not what constitutes a Jew. You don't join the club by sharing the values. You're a Jew because you're born a Jew. It's mishpacha, that's the way it is. And yes, so there'll be different views. We're not so afraid of different views, provided they're all within a framework of MS, as long as there's truth in them. The one thing we're not prepared to tolerate is a deviation from truth. But within that incredibly large structure called MS, called truth, and we've spoken before how MS is made up of three letters, Aleph, Mem, Taf, the first letter, the middle letter, the last letter. MS is very broad, it's very wide. Sheker is narrow. Kuf, Shin, Reish, Shin, Kuf, Reish are three letters very, very close to one another. Just at the end of the alphabet, they're all stuck away there. That's Sheker. When you've got narrowness, you're almost definitely on Sheker. When you've got dogmatism, when you've got intolerance of breadth and intolerance of different outlooks, you've almost definitely got Sheker. MS by its nature has to be broad, it has to be inclusive, it has to be big, one has to be able to weigh things up and see the good and see the bad and see the right and see the wrong. It's incredibly complex when you're dealing with MS. And the Jews, two Jews are Jews because they're born into the same Mishpocha, that's why they're Jews. And in Mishpochas you can have people with different viewpoints, it doesn't matter, you're still part of the same Mishpocha. We don't throw people out of the family because they have different opinions. Or so it used to be until quite recently. Nowadays we do tend to throw people out of our families if they have different opinions. We have become completely tolerant of differences of opinions. Again, differences in things that we demand. Sameness of things? No. That we don't like. Everything must be different. My house must be different. My car must be different. My jewelry must be different. When it comes to opinions, we must all hold the same opinions. Otherwise it's treif. Otherwise it's no good. It's weird. We've twisted the whole perspective around. Rabbi Lau was speaking the other day and he said something very beautiful in the name of the Kotzker Rebbe, where the Gemara says, Kishem She... I think it says Kishem She... Juknan Shob Ne Odom Shonim Ze Mize Kach Dayoseim Shonim Ze Mize. Just as people's appearance differ from one another, so do their opinions differ from one another. And he asked, what difference does it make why the connection? Just say, people have different opinions. We know that. We don't really need the Gemara to tell us that. But why tell us, just as they have different facial forms, so they have different opinions? And the Kotzker Rebbe explained, what do I do if I go to somebody and he looks different to me? I've got brown eyes, he's got blue eyes. I've got a long nose, he's got a short nose. I've got a beard, he hasn't got a beard. What do I go up to him and say, look, I don't want to have anything to do with you. You're not allowed to daven in my shul. I don't want to see you, and I'm not giving you an aliyah if you do come to my shul. Why? Because you haven't got a beard and I have, or because you've got blue eyes and I've got brown eyes. We're not ridiculous, we understand. Everybody looks different. No problem. Kach deyoseim, we've got to be as tolerant of different opinions. Because it is natural for two people to have two different opinions. It is normal for people to have different opinions. That's what creates the excitement of interpersonal interaction. Our only argument has to be on the truth of it. So on that, let's argue, let's discuss. Is it true, isn't it true? But not is it different. Doesn't make any difference if it's different. On the contrary, if it's different, there's a chance we'll be discovering something new, that we're coming to a new understanding, a new perspective. We should flee from imitation. We should flee from sameness when it comes to opinions. We should embrace diversity of opinion. And that's it. An earth, a world capable of creating one Avraham Avinu is worthwhile. There's another element to Bihi Bara, which Rashi brings. And he says, you could read the word again, if you look at the fact that hay is taken out of the word, it's Behei Bara'am. He created them using the hay, using the letter hay. And Rashi points out that the letter hay is open at the bottom. It doesn't have a flaw to it. And not a bays has a flaw, and a chof has a flaw. The letter hay doesn't have a flaw at the bottom. And why that's important is we've often talked about the impact of spiritual gravity. That just as there's physical gravity, that one is drawn down by physical gravity. You're drawn down to the earth. So in spiritual matters, one is naturally drawn down. It is not naturally to elevate. It's not natural to be elevated. It is not natural to be uplifted or to uplift others. It is natural to be drawn down. What's important though is how far down are you drawn? So if you look at physical gravity, you're drawn down to earth. That's as far as you go. When you hit earth, you bump and you stop. That's it. How far down do you go when it comes to spiritual gravity? Says Rashi, the hay has no bottom. There isn't a bottom. You're drawn down and down, but there's not a point at which you hit bottom. It's a continuous process of downward moving if you don't put a stop to it. You have to put a stop to it. Nothing's going to stop you. That's the nature of spiritual gravity. And therefore it says that Rishoyim have the capacity, wicked people have the capacity to fall out of the world, so to say, to deteriorate so far that they no longer have a normal relationship with the world around them. And Behebron, that Hashem created the world in such a way that allows for unlimited deterioration when it comes to things spiritual. There is no limit to how bad we can get. There is no limit to how low we can go. And that's very important to understand. The only thing that helps us create some kind of limit is social pressure. So we become parts of communities where there's certain minimum standards. So at least we hope that by the fact that we're mixing with friends and communities that have certain minimal standards, that we and our children will not fall below that level. That's the role of a community. The role of a community is not to set the upper levels, the upper standards. Each individual must try and get wherever he can in terms of upper standards. The role of a community is to set the bottom standards below which an individual doesn't fall. So these are the stories of Shemayim v'Oretz. B'yom asoyis Hashem Elokim Eretz v'Shemayim. On the day that Hashem created earth and heaven. And again, Rashi and Chazal point out to remind us, in case we've forgotten, the trend that we've seen all the way through. L'medecho shekulom nivru barishon. Everything was created on that first day only. There was no creation thereafter. Right? Eretz and Shemayim, all of it was created up front, in the beginning. From there onwards, it was a process of evolution. Not necessarily the same evolution that Darwin speaks about, but it was an evolutionary process, so to say. A much faster evolutionary process, but it was an evolutionary process. The creation took place only on the first day. Shemayim v'Oretz, as the Ramban said, a little hydrogen atom, that's all that was created on the first day. That was capable of producing everything else for all the rest of the 6 days. One atom was produced, that was it. And then the next three verses, very, very peculiar. Let's have a look at them. V'chol siach hasodeh terem yeyeh v'oretz. And all the vegetation of the field was not yet on the land. V'chol esev hasodeh terem yitzmoch. And all the grass of the field had not yet started to grow. Why? So the creation has taken place already, but if we would have looked at earth at that time, we would have seen a desert. It would have been completely barren. No trees, no grass, no vegetation, nothing. Because there was no rain yet. So how could there be anything? And there was no man to work the land. And a mist was supposed to come up from the earth, to water the whole land. And God formed man from dust of the earth. And he breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, vayihi ha'odam l'nefesh chayo, and man became a living soul. What's the sequence here? What's going on? First there's a creation. Then it tells us that there was nothing there. If you would have looked at the earth, you would have seen a desert. Why? Because there was no rain. Why was there no rain? Because there weren't any human beings yet. What do human beings have to do with rain? They weren't there to work the land. Why? Who needed to work the land? God was still creating. Surely he could have finished the job and created a complete land. And then there's a mist, and then God forms man. What's it all about? Rashi says, well, before we do the Rashi, let's do a medrash on that. Two midrashim. The one says, "Ki loyim tira Hashem alakim el oretz va'odem ayin il mole odom." If it weren't for man, ein bris krusol oretz laham tiroleo. There would be no; it would not be natural for there to be rain. So rain is a function of the human being. The human being produces rain. Take man out of the equation, and there's no rain. We'll understand that in a moment. Another medrash. Amar Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, Gimel Dvorim Shekulim Ze Kazeh. There are three elements in the world equally important. Ve'elohen, and these are they. Eretz, Ve'odom, Umotor. Land, man, and rain. Amar Rabbi Levi Bachia, Ushloishtom Megim Aloysius. They're all spelt with three words. Eretz, Aleph Reish Tzadi, Motor, Mem Tes Reish, Odom, Aleph Dalad Mem. Each of them is spelt with three letters. Lamedecho, Shimein Eretz Ein Motor, Vimein Motor Ein Eretz. To teach you that if there's no land, there'll be no rain. If there's no rain, there'll be no land. Vim Shneim Ein Odom, and if neither of them, there will be no human being. So the idea of a threesome is that if you've got three, if a stool has three legs to it, you can't afford to lose one. Any one leg that is taken away, the stool collapses. If you have four legs, you can afford to have one removed. If one is removed, it can still function. You can still sit on it if you're careful. But if you've got a stool with three legs, take one away, it falls over. It can't survive. So that the idea of the threesome here, there are three of them, Odom, Motor, Oretz, each with three letters, is to show the utter interdependence of the three on one another. Remove any one, and the other two are removed too. Take rain away, there's no humanity, and there's no earth. Take earth away, there's no rain, there's no humanity. Take man away, there's no earth, there's no rain. There's total interdependence between the three. So we're getting a picture that man plays a pivotal role in the production of rain. What is his role? Says Rashi. Lo yotzu elo apesach hakarka. All the vegetation came up to the just to the opening, to the just below the surface of the earth. Omdu ad yom shishi, and they remained there until the sixth day, just under the surface. So again, if you looked at the surface from the air, you would have seen desert. Malama, why? Ki lo himtir, because there was no rain. God produced everything and left it under the surface until the rain would come. Umatam lo himtir, and why didn't he bring rain? Because there was no human being to work the land. Now, here we come across with something very subtle and very critical. The word la'avoid appears in the Torah with two different senses. The one sense is la'avoid, to work, to toil, to work the land, to farm. And the other one is avoidas Hashem. When we talk about serving God, we use the same word. When we talk about serving in the Beis Hamikdash, Avodas Beis Hamikdash, the service of Yom Kippur, Avodas Yom HaKippurim. So the word Avoido, the correct translation of the word Avoido does not mean toil or labor. The correct word for Avoido probably means service. If one were to translate the word Avoido, one should translate it as service. And service can be two ways. Either you're serving human beings with your work, with your profession, or you're serving God. And it's interesting that the same word is used, and if the Torah uses the same word, that's because we're dealing with the same root concept. That whether you're serving God or you're serving mankind in your work, there's a certain overlap, there's a certain common understanding which we need to grasp. And it's interesting that an Eved is the same kind of concept, which means that the Eved then is not a slave, an Eved is a servant. Somebody who serves. And in our business today, where the emphasis is on service excellence, what are we saying? We are producing slaves. We want avodim. Avodim, an eved is a person whose total dedication is to serve the customer or to serve his master. And all of the service, and so it is with Hashem. We want service to Hashem. The concept of service, of complete dedication to the other person, or to the other being. Now here it says, the Odom Ayin La'avoid Eso Adomo, there is not yet a man to work the soil. We're going to start discovering in this Rashi what that common point is of the two meanings of Avoido. Avoido meaning toil, and Avoido meaning the service of God. What is the two? Now every other religion, in every other religion, there is no connection. In every other religion, there are two completely different words. You won't find a religion that has the same word for service of God and service at work. It's two different concepts, two different ideas. Not only are they different, but they're mutually exclusive in other religions. If you want to serve God, you've got to stop working. If you want to work, you can't serve God. You've got to make a choice. That's how other religions operate. We're not like that. We believe that there's a very close affinity between working and serving God. What is that affinity? Says Rashi. Matam lo himtir. Why didn't God bring rain? Lefisha Odom, ayin la'avod yisar Odom, because there's nobody to, no man to walk, work the earth. Ve'ein makir b'toivoson shel geshomim. And if there's nobody to work the earth, there's nobody to appreciate the value of rain. Uchashebo Odom ve'yodo shem tzorich le'ilom. And when man came along and said, we need rain, I can't work without rain. Hispayel aleihem, he turned to Hashem and davened, please bring rain. Ve'yodu, then the rain came, v'tzomchu ha'ilonus v'adushoyim, and the grass grew. What do we see from here? We see an amazing relationship between work, acknowledgement, appreciation, and prayer. And rain, of course. And what is prayer? Well, let's start with what is appreciation. We think that if you do something, then somebody shows appreciation for it. So we regard showing appreciation as being a response to receiving something. You receive something, so you show appreciation. Not according to Rashi, and I'll show you that Rashi is quite right, it's exactly the other way around. Giving something to you is the response to appreciation. When somebody is appreciative, you want to give, and you want to give more. It's the appreciation which elicits giving, not giving which elicits appreciation. It's the way you appreciate that determines how much people give. And it's the level of appreciation. Appreciation is not the response to giving. Appreciation causes giving. And if people aren't giving, very often it's because they're operating in an environment that is non-appreciative. You can't go on giving in an environment that's non-appreciative. Why do people clap when they go to a concert and it's a good concert? Why do they clap? To show appreciation. But if you notice, they very often clap before the concert. When the conductor gets onto the stage, they're clapping already. He's done nothing. What are they showing appreciation for? Why are they clapping? They're giving him a taste of it. They're saying, we're an appreciative audience, and if you give us a good evening, oh, well, we give you applause. And that begins the whole relationship. It's terribly important if you want somebody to give, show appreciation. Before they give already, indicate to the giver that you're an appreciative person. That if he gives, it will be welcomed. That if he gives, it will be appreciated. And who do we learn that from? From Hashem. Hashem doesn't give rain until somebody shows appreciation. Until somebody indicates, if you give it to me, I'll say thank you, Hashem. Then he'll give rain. And until that time, he won't. And if Hashem doesn't, nor do we have to. We are under no obligation to give to non-appreciative people. If we do, then it's charity. Something that we do, as an act of charity, but not as an act of social interaction. Not as an act of chesed. And I've had discussions with the chesed committee of our own shul, and I sometimes get unpopular because I sometimes tell them, don't give that person. Stop it. It's enough already. How long have you been giving and what kind of appreciation have you been getting? Nothing. What kind of appreciation has the shul been getting? Nothing. So stop. Stop making an idiot of yourself. There's no requirement to carry on and on and on and on giving chesed to spoiled brats. No obligation. That's how you destroy children. By giving and giving and giving without eliciting the ability in the child to show appreciation. And it's not even, I'll give and then you'll say thank you. You'll say thank you, then I'll give. You indicate to me that you value what I have to give, and then I'll give it. And if you can't indicate to me that you value what I have to give, it's too valuable to me to give to you. I'll give it to somebody who values it. I won't give it to somebody who doesn't value it. That applies to material things. That applies to emotional things. That applies to intellectual things, to spiritual things. Generous people love to share. But they love to share with people who value. Nobody loves to share something precious with people who don't value it. And if you do, it simply indicates that you don't value what you're giving. If you're willing to share something with people who don't value it, that simply indicates that you don't value it. Otherwise, why would you be doing that? So you'd be giving a Devar Torah, or to be giving a speech or whatever at a wedding while people are speaking and eating. It's ridiculous. Why would you do such a thing? The people are saying, we don't value what you have to say. So what are you saying it for? Because you have a need to speak. Sit down. There's no need to do that. There's no need to belittle oneself and to devalue that which one is offering. It is necessary for the recipient to indicate his capacity to appreciate what you have to give. If he doesn't have that capacity, you don't give. And Hashem teaches us that. I've got rain. And rain is precious because without rain there is no life. Without rain there is no orit, there is no earth. Without rain there is no humanity. The whole thing will collapse. If I don't bring rain. And I won't bring it until somebody shows me he values it. That's how Hashem. And he's willing to risk the entire Bria, the entire creation, he's willing to place at risk. So Adam comes along, and that's why Adam, ayin la'avoy desu Adama. How do you get to the point of appreciating rain? There's only one person who can appreciate rain, and that's a farmer. You will not appreciate rain if you're not working the earth. If you're sitting in Johannesburg and every time you want water you open the tap, you're not going to appreciate rain. When we had these water restrictions and so on, and they started fining people large amounts of money who used an exceedingly large amount of water, or not such an exceedingly large amount of water, that's not going to teach people anything. That's not how you learn appreciation. What should they have done? Just turn the taps off. Just turn the water supply off. That's all. We'll allow a certain amount of water a day, and when that amount has been reached, the taps will be turned off. There will be no more water. Then see how long it would take for people to start realizing it's valuable, it's rare, it's not easily available, better be careful. That's how we understand when things, unfortunately, we're that way. Only when we've grappled with loss do we understand true value. Only when we've grappled with the absence of something do we understand the presence of something. And it's sad that sometimes we have to actually lose it. It's far better if we can use our imagination to imagine what it's like to lose it. We should do that with our friends, we should do that with our relatives, with our family. Imagine what it would be like, chas v'shalom, if we didn't have them. And if we really use our imagination, we'll begin to get to some kind of appreciation. Or through sharing loss with other people. And to see what they're going through, to understand that way what it means. And so the only types of people who can possibly appreciate what rain is, are people who need rain on a daily basis, the people who are working the land. So it lands up that working the land becomes a precondition for understanding the need for rain. What happens when you need rain? Who do you go to for rain? There's no water. The lakes are empty. The dams are empty. The rivers are empty. There's no water in the world anywhere. There's salt water in the ocean. That's all. What do? Adam turns to Hashem and says, Hashem, Geshem, bring some rain. What is it called when we daven? Avoido. That's called Avoido. Same word. When we say Al Shloisha Dvarim Ha'ilam Oimed, that the world stands on three things, Al HaTorah, Al HaAvoido of Al Gemilus Chasodim. Avoido used to be the temple service. Today Avoido is prayer. Communicating with Hashem, asking Hashem for what we need. The only way you can ask Hashem what you need is if you have an absence, if you have a loss, if you see the void. A person who's not working doesn't understand what it is to need money. A person who's not working doesn't understand what it is to have atzlocha. A person who isn't involved in business doesn't know what it means to have to ask God to help. He assumes it just happens. And that's the difference between the mentality of the civil servant and the mentality of the businessman, the entrepreneur. The civil servant, it's like the water. He gets a salary at the end of the month. That's it. He doesn't have to ask God for anything. All he's got to do is keep in the good books of his boss, because his boss determines his salary. And he thinks he's a religious Jew. He isn't a religious Jew, he's an idol worshipper. He worships his boss. That's what it is. He really believes, if you said to him, what do you need to do to get a salary increase? His answer is likely to be, I've got to see that I'm at work on time, do my work properly, try and keep in the good books of my boss. That's what I need to do. Doesn't mention Hashem. You say to a businessman, an entrepreneur, you say, what do you need to do in order to be matzliach? I don't know what it is. Sometimes I try and it doesn't work. Sometimes I don't try and it does work. Hashem, what do I know? Hashem seems to be doing it. He knows it. That's avoido. That's the linkage between avoido and avoido. Only if you are engaged in the reality of interacting in the world, whether it's in farming or it's in business or whatever area it is, does the person really begin to understand what it is not to have what he needs and to turn to Hashem in prayer, in avoido, and to really ask him for what he needs. And so we find exactly the same word used in the sense of avodas Hashem, serving of God, and avoda the work in the world. It's interesting that there are two approaches. The Gemara in Brochus brings two approaches, Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai and Rabbi Yishmoel, different ways as to whether one should work at all, or whether one should be involved only in Torah, Gemara, and since then that discussion has long existed since then. What's important in that whole discussion is this principle. Do I have the capacity to appreciate the need for that which makes the world go round? If I do, if I have the capacity to understand it, and to understand the need for it, one can understand the need for rain, even if one isn't a farmer, but one has to be on a certain level. One can understand the need for hatzlocha in the material area, for success in the material area, even if one's sitting and learning all day, provided one's engaged in the world in a realistic sort of way. There's a real interaction with the world. Where it becomes difficult is where one isolates oneself from the real world, when one's engagement with people is on a level which is not real, which is not natural, but one becomes separated from the natural process. And avodah emphasizes the need for natural process, to understand what we need in order to make the world successful, and who has the keys to those needs. Who has what it takes to make the world successful? As we're more engaged in the world, whether it's an interpersonal engagement, or business engagement, or professional engagement, or educational engagement, as we're more engaged in the world, we appreciate more and more that those keys are in Hashem's hands. This linkage between appreciation and prayer, and the power of that, we see in a number of different areas. One of them is in a medrash, a really wonderful medrash, where Hashem says to Moshe, go and bring the Jewish people out of Egypt. The time has come. Now, a clearer and more dramatic instruction than that we don't have anywhere in the Torah. Now, Hashem instructs Moshe, the time has finally come. Get the Jews out of Egypt. The whole nation, this is going to be the most dramatic miracle that has ever taken place and ever will take place. You, Moshe, have been identified to lead this miracle. You're going to bring them to our Sinai. They're going to get the Torah. This is going to be the climax of human achievement and of religious achievement, about to take place. What would we expect Moshe to do? And God tells him himself. He hears God's voice with prophecy. Hashem says to him, Moshe, Moshe, you're the person. You've got to do it. What does Moshe do? One would think he would go running. Says the Torah, Vayelech Moshe, Vayoshev el Yeso Chosnoi. Moshe says, yes, okay, but I'm afraid I can't go at the moment, God. Just hang on a second. It's really interesting. Imagine if Rav Shach phoned you up and said, you know, I need you to do something. Can you do it for me right away? Sure. Yes, boss. Down the phone. The Havdil, Mr. Mandela phones you up. No, I really need you. Can you get here quickly? Yes, boss. There right away. Hashem calls Moshe up, says, I need you right away. What for? To take the Jews out of Egypt. Right now I need you. Says Moshe, sorry, boss. Eini yochel. Can't. Fine, I can't do it. Why? Mipnei shekibloni Yisroel. Fosach li beiso. What do you think? I can just walk out of my host's house? I'm a guest in Yisroel's house. Vani imoy kaveni. He treats me like a child. And I run his business. He's dependent on me. I can't just walk out. Yes, but Moshe, you've got an incredible career opportunity here. You're just a business manager for Yisrael, and I'm talking about appointing you president of a nation. Do you realize what that is? You're managing a couple of sheep at the moment. I'm talking about you managing millions of people. What kind of a salary does he pay you? You know what you're going to get this way? This is an incredible career opportunity I'm offering you. Says Moshe, Taplak. I can't go without it. Yisro will have to agree. That's Moshe Rabbein. That's Moshe. Why? Shaposeach pischoy lechaveiroi nafshu chayivlo. Because if somebody opens his home to you, you can never repay that debt. Now, if you don't like that, don't accept it. Don't stay with anybody. But if somebody opens their home to you, you are indebted for life. V'chein ata moitze be'eliyo. And so you find with Eliyahu, b'shor sholach etzel tzufis ha'amono, meis b'no. Eliyahu was being taken care of by the widow Tzorfis. She took care of him, gave him lodging. And her son died. Hischil mischanein v'omer, Eliyahu prayed to Hashem. Son's dead. And says, ha'gam ala almono asher ani misgoherimo harayoy solami, says b'no. Hashem, how could you do this? The widow who's opened her home to me, I stay there, I live there. How can you do that to her? And Hashem listened to Eliyahu and gave the breath back to the boy. What does he say? Says that, what was the power of prayer there? Eliyahu knew what prayer to use. Eliyahu says, I owe this woman my life. She opened her home to me. And opening a home is like providing a life. And how can you take her son away? How can you cause the death of her son while I'm in her home? It's not okay. So Hashem revives the son. What power is he using to master this power of prayer? Hakoros HaTov, acknowledgement. I owe her my life. I can't allow this to happen. V'loyoit, says the Medrash. Not only that. If somebody opens their home to you, you owe them more than your own mother and father. And you know what kovod you owe a mother and father? What honor, what dignity one owes a mother and father? The din is you owe a person who's opened his home to you more than a mother and father. Mother and father, it's natural for them to do. But for somebody else to open their home to you is not natural. And it brings the proof from Eliyahu once again. If Eliyahu had the capacity to pray for the revival of the dead, and he was able to revive this young boy, and Elisha could do the same, why didn't they go to the cemetery and revive their own parents? Surely that's their first obligation. If they have the power to revive the dead, why didn't they go and revive their parents? Says the Medrash, because they didn't owe their parents enough. You owe a person who opens his home to you more than you owe a parent, and that debt gives the power of prayer that is capable to revive the dead. You can even bring life to a person who doesn't have life with that power of death. It's limitless, the power of that kind of prayer. And that's the essence of prayer, is hakoros hatov, is gratitude. Prayer is an expression of gratitude. Prayer is an expression of indebtedness. Prayer is an understanding of the value of that which you're asking for. And Reb Chaim Shmuel Levitz uses that medrash to explain how B'nai Yisrael could say to Hashem when Moshe was about to die. Rashi says in Hazinu that the B'nai Yisrael said, we won't let him. Forget it. Moshe's not going. We won't let him. We won't let him die. And Hashem says, Ve'etzem, I'll do it in the middle of the day. They'll see. They won't be able to stop me. Just as I did it with Noach and as I did it with Paro. Ask some Chai B'Shmuel Levitz. I understand how the people in Noach's day thought they could stop Noach. They would physically come and keep him out of the ark. They would... hundreds, thousands of them would come and they would hold Noach down. How difficult is it? But how did the Jewish people think they were going to stop Moshe dying? What were they going to do? Says Reb Chaim Shmuel Levitz, with the power of gratitude, they could have stopped him dying. With the power of Hakoros HaTov, they could have stopped Hashem's ability, so to say, to take Moshe away. And Hashem says, I won't let them. But they could have theoretically done that. That's the power of Hakoros HaTov. That's the power of appreciation. And that's when we're praying for somebody. Somebody's ill. Excuse me. When we're praying for somebody, one of the most powerful elements to introduce into the prayer is, this person did something for me. I owe something to this person. How can I stand by while he's suffering? How can I stand by while he's ill? You've got to do something for me, Hashem. I owe this person the debt of gratitude, and therefore you have to heal him or whatever. And so we see over and over again this connection arising between appreciation and prayer. And appreciation can only come when one's had the loss. And having the loss can only come when the work is taking place. There was no man to work the land. And since there was no man to work the land, there was nobody to truly ask God for what needed to be achieved. The Medrash says it slightly differently. The Odom ain lavei desa adomo. The Odom Ayin Lahaavid es Habrius Lahakadosh Baruch Hu. An additional meaning of Avodah. Says the Medrash, what does it mean that there wasn't man to work the land, to work on the land, to work with the land? But Lahavid es Adomo explains the Medrash, it's not to work the land. That wasn't what Odom was created for. Odom wasn't created to be a farmer. That wasn't his mission in life. Adam was created Lahaavid es Habrius Lahakadosh Baruch Hu, to work people around to God. That's what he had to do. That's what man has to do. Lahaavid es Habrius Lahakadosh Baruch Hu, to work people around to God. Ke Eliyahu uchechoni hamagol, like Eliyahu and Choni hamagol, who demonstrated to mankind that God was the source of rain when there was drought. They showed that it was prayer that was able to bring rain. And that's when God brings rain. The purpose of bringing rain is when he's able to show people that he's the source of that rain. It's interesting, if you look at the next pasuk, the Eid Yale Min Oretz V'Hishkos Kopnei Adomo, the relationship between earth and rain. There is a mist. Moisture arises from the earth and forms clouds. And clouds bring down the rain and wet the earth. And the earth, there's evaporation and the moisture goes up. And so it is. It's a backwards and forwards. Rain is really a... a backwards and forwarding of moisture from the earth upwards and from the clouds down to earth again. And this relationship, again, is a very similar one to prayer. It starts with us. We want goodness from Hashem. There's got to be a movement upwards. And it's a Russo, the Tator, we call it. An arousal from below. We have to do something to arouse God's interest. What is it that we have to do is to show Him appreciation, that we value what we're asking for. And then there's an Isarusa de la Elo. Then there's an arousal from above. The rain comes down. When the rain comes down, we once again have to say thank you and ask for more, and that again generates. It's a complete circular dynamic that takes place constantly. So Arusa de la Elo, Isarusa de la Tato. Constantly, we're having to set in motion the process from below so that God can respond. God responds so that we can react, and so it goes backwards and forwards, and that in fact is the essence of prayer. So here we've got prayer introduced at the very origin.